How many of you enjoy a road trip? All right, four. Okay, a few more. Kind of depends on the road and the reason for the trip, right? That's often the case. I thought I would read to you by way of introduction 35 things not to forget on your next family road trip. You'll probably find some of them practical, some of them humorous. I won't go through all 35. I'll try to draw a few highlights. Road trip time. First on this person's list was grocery store trash bags. She writes, I save grocery store trash bags specifically for car rides and airplane rides. We have two children with varying degrees of motion sickness, and these always come in handy. So if you're going to use grocery store bags, you have to be sure that the plastic is sealed all the way, because some of them are not. Second most important thing you tell this as a family, wet wipes. Chances are kids are going to want to eat snacks on the long drive, so having wet wipes available to clean them up before and after is essential any road trip. Number three, Kleenex. Can you see? These are messy kids, these three. Four, cell phone. Not many of us would forget to bring one, but use it to download handy travel apps and maps. Again, if you run out of cell service, most road trip lists will ask you, be sure to have a paper map, because there'll be areas that you just won't get cell service and Google won't be able to tell you where to turn anymore. So you need that. Portable charger and cords, camera, books. Movies. Now, how many of us, when we grew up, had movies in the car? We didn't have movies at home. We didn't go to the movies only on a very rare occasion. So this is talk about entertainment. How is it possible for kids to fight in the car anymore? I mean, how do you learn to really be patient with your brothers and sisters if you're watching movies all the time? It's difficult to learn self-control, I'll just add that, when you're sitting in front of a screen all the time. So maybe self-control is better. Activities and games, water, insulated water bottles, music playlist, snacks, cooler, first aid kit, blankets, pillows, stuffed animals, which she calls loveys. If your child has a favorite toy or stuffed animal, do not forget it, or you may be turning the car around to go back for it. Change of clothes. Flip-flops, towels, paper towels, notes and colored pencils, map, wallet, sunglasses, bug spray, flashlight, extra diapers, wipes, formula, baby food, a football or a frisbee, headphones. If you don't want to listen to SpongeBob SquarePants for 3 hours straight, bring headphones. Better yet, bring them for the kids. Just kind of put them in their own little world and hope you'll be fine. Spare set of keys, car emergency kit. Check the car before setting out. And last but not least, number 35, don't forget your patience. Because it's going to be a long ride. Many of us enjoy road trips with the right people to the right location at the right time. Other than that, they can be a bit of a problem. Now, Israel had a massive road trip on their hands. As they left the nation, the territory of Egypt, they were going to be traveling through pretty harsh desert conditions to get to where God was taking them. You might say they were on the ultimate 3,500 year ago road trip. All the kids, all the stuff, all the animals, everything was going along. What does Israel's trip to the promised land tell us about God? What does their road trip tell us about our lives today? I mean, if God oversaw the traveling of hundreds of thousands of Israelites across the wilderness, could there be parallels for our day and our lives today? So what I'd like to do with you over the next hour is explore the lessons that we can learn from Israel's road trip in the wilderness. Their time from Egypt toward the promised land. I think in this sermon we'll be able to identify maybe a two-part sermon. What we can learn about God from the experience of Israel in the wilderness. Israel's journey toward the promised land has many important parallels that will help us toward our journey toward the promised land of the kingdom of God, life in God's family. I'd like to begin with you by turning to Numbers chapter 33 for lesson number one. Lesson number one, God will help us. God will help us. You know, there are times in our lives that truly becomes a question for us. Is God going to help me? Is God going to intervene? Will God help? Numbers chapter 33, beginning in verse 1, reminds us, we'll read through verse 4, that God will help us, that He has started us on this journey toward the promised land, and He will see us through, regardless of the detours or the troubles that might come along the way. Numbers 33 and verse 1. These are the journeys of the children of Israel. So we got summary statements here. Who went out of the land of Egypt by their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now Moses wrote down the starting points of their journeys at the command of the Eternal. So God said, you know, Moses, I want you to keep a road diary, a trip diary. Write down your waypoints, where you stopped, where you start. And these are the journeys according to their starting points. They departed from Ramesses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover, so on the first day of unleavened bread. The children of Israel went out with holiness, with boldness, I should say, in the sight of all the Egyptians. Now, how were they able to start this trip? Well, because God helped them. In our conversion, God has called us. He's opened our mind, and He's begun us on a fantastic road trip, unlike anyone else in the world is traveling. We have a unique calling. Verse 4, how did He spring them onto the road, we might say? For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Eternal had killed among them. Also on their gods, the Eternal had executed judgments. So the children of Israel left Ramesses, left Egypt after the Passover with a high hand, with boldness. And in the same way, God will step into our world to launch us first on our calling, our pursuit toward the kingdom of God. He has special instructions for each of us as individuals as we prepare for the road trip. And He does promise to step into our world and break whatever bonds might be holding us, helping us to escape from sin. We've just been through that lesson with the days of unleavened bread. There is no force, there is no power too great for God to break down and destroy. He did so with the most powerful, probably at least in this region, very likely in the world at this point, the most powerful nation that had existed at that time. Again, at least in this portion of the world. I don't know that we can discount the Far East, but the point is, here was the powerful nation. And God simply broke it down bit by bit to spring His people free. So no matter what stands against us, our God has the power to save. He will help. He would not have started us on this journey if He did not want us to complete it, if He would not offer the help for us to complete it. So let's turn to Exodus 13 for lesson number two. Exodus 13, and we'll read in verse 20. It's very similar to point number one, but a reminder that God will lead us. God will lead us. We're not just talking about God helping us. We're also talking about God leading us. I mean, it's one thing on a road trip to set you on the road. But if you have no map of what value is being put out on the road with a chance to go somewhere, if we don't know where we're going or why we're going there, God promised to lead Israel. And he did so every single day, through the pillar, through the cloud. Exodus chapter 13 and verse 20. So they took their journey. So this is the actual diary. Numbers was the kind of the summary statement we just read. So they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. So in other words, they're at a point now that they're leaving, in essence, what is the settled area, the populated area next to Egypt. And they're going off into the wilderness where there are not settlements for them to come to. Verse 21, and the Eternal went before them. I would imagine that when you were called, there was a bit of question. Maybe you grew up in the church and there was that time that you reached kind of adulthood and you've got to make some adult decisions and we've got to sort through, where is my life going? What responsibilities do I have toward God for the truth that he's revealed to me? In this case, they're at the edge of the wilderness. When we were called or we came to maturity, we were literally at the edge of our spiritual wilderness. And we needed direction. We needed God to guide us, to lead us. So the Lord, verse 21, went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way. Now, I've never seen a pillar of cloud. I've seen horizontal clouds, but never a pillar. I mean, I've seen puffy clouds, but this is a pillar. A pillar of cloud. To do what? To lead the way. And by night, a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. So whenever God wanted to travel, them to travel, he led them. Now there's a couple things about this. He led them by a cloud during the day. Why would a cloud be important in the desert? Well, for shade. If any of you have been in desert-like conditions, just a little bit of shade makes a huge difference. And you can see why Jonah, when he was in a similar circumstance, had this one little plant growing up, and he was so thankful for this little plant that provided just a little bit of cover for him. And of course, when it died, when God allowed the plant to die, Job was really upset. There goes my shade. Come on, God, what are you doing here? And God used it to teach Jonah a lesson. Jonah, you're concerned about this plant? And you're not concerned about these Ninevites, real human beings, the potential for being in my family as we would understand it? You're not concerned about them? You're angry that I'm going to help them, that I'm going to forgive them? The point was, a little bit of shade in the desert is a wonderful thing. Well, if you're in the desert, why would you want fire? Well, because when the sun sets in the desert, the temperature can drop 20, 30, 40, 50 degrees. Remember camping one time on a bicycle trip. We did a team bicycle tour through Death Valley in California. And during the day, it was well into the 90s and the low 100s, sometimes up to 110. But it would literally drop into the 40s at night. So here we are, bicycling through the desert with insulated sleeping bags on the back of our bikes so that when it got to be 4 a.m, you could cover up and you wouldn't just be chilled to the bone, hoping the sun would come back up, and then by the middle of the day, hoping that you could find some shade somewhere. So God gave them a pillar of fire at night, and you wonder if that wasn't for some heat as well. So will not God lead us as his spiritual church in a similar fashion? Not just corporately as the entire group, but can we depend on God individually? I mean, God showed some very obvious physical way here that he was leading the people. When the pillar stood, the people set up camp. When the pillar either moved day or night, and you think, well, why would God move people in the middle of the night? Well, if the desert was going to be particularly hot, the wilderness, the next day, maybe God would start them in the evening and march through the night so they would be cooler and more comfortable. We had to trust, they had to trust God that he would move at the perfect time. So God rescues Israel and leads them out of Egypt. And today God calls us out of our own personal slavery of sin and begins to lead us according to the pillar of the cloud and the fire. So one of the things we pray about is that God would make his lead obvious. You know, Israel did not have to have the level of faith that God expects of you. Cloud's there, it moves, I move. Now, I can question the cloud as to why it's moving at this time and where exactly it's going, but it's pretty obvious God is leading. And then when you end up in a decent place to camp, okay, it's pretty obvious why he did this. God expects more of me and you. We don't have our cloud, our pillar of fire. So God expects us to develop faith. Our journey is not moving our tent from place to place, but our journey is living a daily life under God's guidance. And that clearly requires, in fact, forces us to develop greater faith in our lives. We don't see the pillar, so we have to trust God. And so we often pray, and I'd encourage you to do the same, that God would make it obvious what he wants us to do. Because I tend to be rather thick-headed. And so sometimes a slap upside the head or something that's a little bit more obvious can be very, very useful. We want God to lead us, and we want to follow that lead, but we have to know where it is. So we ask God to make it obvious to us, and God often does that. Now, there are times that he does not make it particularly obvious because he wants us to grow. And if he made it obvious, we might not stay closer to him. We might not develop the kind of wisdom and judgment that he also wants us to develop along the way. But I don't think it's wrong, and I'd always encourage it, to ask God to make it easy. Make it easy. Help me to learn the easy way. Help me to see your guidance, your direction, the easy way. Now, if you've got other things in mind for me, so be it, but we always can ask. You know, Dad can sometimes say, no, you need to grow a little bit here in a different way. Or he may say, yeah, here's the answer. Here's the direction. Here's the guidance. Third lesson. As Israel leaves Egypt here in Exodus 13, is this. God's lead is very loving. God's lead is very loving. I think it's important to remind ourselves of that. Because sometimes we may not see that on the surface. Exodus 13 in verse 17. And it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. Pause for a second. The path to the Philistines was along the coast. This was by far the easiest method of travel because it was pretty much flat all along the Gulf Coast up into the Philistine area and into the Promised Land, we might say, from the west into the east. But God didn't lead them that way, even though that was the easiest path. Well, you think if God was really loving, surely he would lead them along the easiest path. It would require the least amount of work. And then we remind ourselves that too much leisure, too much ease, just isn't good for human beings. Just isn't good for human beings. You know, one of the things that God said about Sodom before he condemned them was that they had too much leisure. Didn't work enough. Now again, if you look at some of our parallels today and you wonder if some of those things aren't the same in our culture today. They had too much time on their hands. They wasted it and they got into things they should never have gotten involved with. So God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although it was near. Rest of verse 17, for God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. God was leading them in a very kind and loving way. He didn't want them to be frightened. Now, they didn't have to be frightened, but he thought they would be. As soon as they saw armies gathering along that way of the coast, which there would have been certainly Philistine armies and some prior to that possibly, they'd be afraid and they'd run back to Egypt. I think sometimes we underestimate that God knew Israel through and through. He knew their tendencies. He knew their strengths. He knew their weaknesses. So he led them in a way that took all these things into consideration. He said they're better at walking than they are trusting. So we'll take them a little bit harder way, but they won't have to be afraid. They won't be frightened. And I wonder if God at this point in the story is simply saying that by the miracles that I've performed and by the miracles they'll see throughout the wilderness, their faith might be able to be strengthened a bit so that when war would come, and it didn't have to, but if it would, they would trust God a little more thoroughly. He knew Israel far better than they knew themselves. And can we say the same thing about us, that God knows me and you through and through, better than we know ourselves? I want to pause. You don't necessarily have to turn there, but I'll read to you Psalm 103, verses 13 and 14. As a father pities his children, so the Eternal pities those who fear him. And pity in this context does not mean to feel pity in the sense of, oh, you poor little worthless thing. You're pitiful. That's not the context of this word. As a father pities, in this case, pity means to just tenderly care for. As a father tenderly cares for his children. I mean, you don't go around with your children and say, you're pitiful. I hope you don't anyway. I hope they're not. But the point is, this is a tender concern and a love. And then he goes on to say in verse 14, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. In other words, we might say, that's, again, you can jot that down. Psalm 103, verses 13 and 14. The point is, God knows us. He knows what we're capable of, and he has pity for us. In other words, a tender care. He understands. A modern way of saying it is God cuts us an awful lot of slack because he knows that we're not spiritual dynamos necessarily at this point in our lives or at this time. So he gives us a great deal of mercy, cuts us a lot of slack. And again, that should be a side reminder that we should do that for each other. Cut each other a lot of slack. God knows who we are. We need to be as understanding toward each other as God is toward us. His lead is very loving. So when God leads us, it is in a direction and through various circumstances that will be for our benefit. And that takes, again, a development of faith to trust God to do that. Leads us to lesson number four. Flip a page over in Exodus chapter 14. Lesson number four, God's lead often has multiple purposes. God's lead often has multiple purposes. Here in Exodus chapter 14, we might assume that God's primary purpose was to help Israel escape from Egypt, and that God would then lead them to the promised land. But notice what's said here. The Lord said to Moses, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2 of chapter 14, speak to the children of Israel, if they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon, you shall camp before it by the sea. You've all heard this story any number of times. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in. I'll pause for a second. Again, the assumption is God's primary purpose is just to get the people to the promised land. But then we realize, well, there's multiple layers in this situation. There is, yes, God's desire to get them to the promised land, but there are essential lessons for them to learn in between. trust being one of them, God's power being another one of them. And yet at the same time, God is also working with the Egyptians to teach them. So while Israel is the focus, God is still working with Israel. In fact, he's not just working with Egypt, I should say, not just working with Egypt. He's working with all the surrounding nations, because these stories of God's power will begin to sift through and filter into Canaan. So 40 years later, the people of Jericho are terrified of the Israelites as they're approaching, because they've heard these stories. So God's working with those people 40 years in advance, we might say. At least some years in advance, without a doubt. Verse 4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh. So God is also working to glorify his own name and to show his power, to show his love, to show his kindness toward his people in the midst of the trial for Israel. I'll gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am Yahweh, I'm the Eternal. And they did so. So God's also working with all the Egyptians. And you wonder which one of them may at some point have followed the God of Israel because their heart was tender toward these things that had happened. So God says his primary purpose, of course, is to bring Israel to the promised land. Yet multiple purposes show his complete supremacy in destroying the Egyptian army, his working with the Israelites, his working with the Egyptians. And I think it's true that oftentimes in our lives, we feel that God has or should have one thing or another as his primary purpose. When I'm sick, I feel God's primary purpose should be to heal me, right? It's pretty obvious. I'm sick. I'm not well. He can heal. That should be his goal. That's what we would like. Yet, God may have multiple purposes at work. Maybe he wants me to develop more faith, more trust, that even though I don't feel better yet, that God will take care of me. He might be developing our spouse's faith through our sickness, our children's faith, our parents' faith, having them trust God. And maybe the trial is more for them than for me or for you. That certainly might be the case. Can God be using this trial to develop the love of the brethren, to care for those who are sick, to remember them in their prayers, to do kind things for them? Can God also be working on developing patience in me through a trial of some sort, and a trial of sickness for that matter? Can God also be asking me to develop a godly attitude as a caregiver for someone who is sick, to patiently care for those that are ill or sick? Can God be desiring that I preach the gospel to future brethren by my attitude during a trial, during a sickness, emphasizing the need for life beyond the grave, eternal life be granted? So there are many, many levels on which God can work all at once, all at the same time, through a various trial. So in the same way that God was working with Israel, was working with Egypt, was working with Pharaoh, was working with the Canaanites, was working with the other nations around all at the same time through the same trial, God is a master when it comes to multi-layer accomplishment through these series of events. So God's lead in our lives sometimes has multiple purposes. We go through a financial trial. What are we to learn from this? Well, maybe we're to learn stewardship. Maybe we're to learn faith. Maybe we're to learn that, you know, the righteous suffer because of the unrighteous and the persecution we might receive for keeping the Sabbath or things like that. So many, many levels that we can ask God to teach us through these challenges and difficulties. Lesson number 5. We'll stay here in Exodus chapter 14. Lesson number 5. God will fight our battles. God will fight our battles. Exodus 14, in verse 9, as you know, Pharaoh, the Egyptians, pursued them. All the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, understandably so. We can always say, well, we should never be afraid. Yeah, nice idea. I wish it could be that way. Maybe one day we'll be so full of faith that fear just will not enter. Hope that can be the case. We talked previously about not living our lives in fear. But you've got this unexpected event. Here marches the Egyptians. After all that God did to the Egyptians, they're still marching after them. And they're going to slay however many they need to capture the rest. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal. You know, for once, Israel did the right thing. Well, they were not being afraid, but they cried out to the Eternal. That was a good thing, but very short-lived, because verse 11 says, "Then they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, you've taken us away to die in the wilderness. Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt?'" So, for a very short moment, they cried out to God, and then they blamed Moses. Well, what did they need to learn? Well, they needed to learn that God would fight their battles. "Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians that we should die than that we should die in the wilderness." Israel is just so famous for their bad attitudes. And that's probably not something we talk as much about in the church these days as we may have in the past. And maybe it was overdone. But attitude really is everything. It really is. And a bad attitude, in this case, lack of faith, a faithless attitude, is just so destructive in so many ways. Verse 13, "Moses said to the people, 'Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians, whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. Do not be afraid.'" Again, we talked last week about how fear and faith tend to be on a balance beam. And the more that our faith increases, the more faith, or I should say fear, decreases. And the opposite is often true. When fear increases and faith decreases. So Moses was asking them to be faithful. Be men and women of faith. "Stand still and watched. Watch, which he will accomplish for you today." Verse 14, "The Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." Other translations render that, "You shall be quiet." Just be quiet. Now, maybe he meant that. The way I tend to read it is, the Lord will fight for you, and he's going to shut you up. That's the way I read it. He's going to shut you up by his actions. Now, maybe that's not quite the way. Maybe Moses meant God will act and then you'll be calm. You'll be quiet. Maybe that's what he meant. Maybe that's the kinder, gentler interpretation of that. Point is, God will fight our battles as well. It's challenging for us sometimes to see that sometimes God leads us into a place like the Israelites had camped. I mean, how'd they get there? God brought them to this place so that he could show them His power, His intervention, His love for them. Certainly didn't look that way as the Egyptians are marching toward them. But we must take a long distance view of the trials that we face, because they're intended to train us for God's kingdom, to prepare us for the promised land, we might say. And this was one of the preparations for the promised land. I mean, all the plagues were, the death of the firstborn was, the escape from Egypt, raiding the Egyptians and becoming a wealthy nation overnight, with all kinds of tons of gold and silver robbed from the Egyptians or taken as payment for 400 years of slavery. I mean, all these things happen overnight. God, one by one, is showing them these great miracles to help them on their journey to the promised land. So God will fight our battles, and we must trust that He allows us and brings us to the places that we are so that He can further accomplish what He desires in us. And sometimes that long-term view is very challenging to take. With that, let's go on to number six. Lesson number six. It's also here in Exodus 14, and that is God will provide a way of escape. God will provide a way of escape. Sometimes the way God fights our battles is to open the back door for us, not to teach us how to use a sword. God often provides a way of escape in an unexpected manner. Exodus 14, here in verse 15. We'll continue on. The Eternal said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." Now, you have any number of miracles taking place for this to happen. First of all, the waters parting is a miracle. Now, people have tried to sort through, where did Israel cross? And that's an interesting study of and by itself. And some have found what they consider to be a natural land bridge, and they feel they've located that. That's only really not that many feet under the water of the Red Sea. And that may be the case. I think there's some fascinating facts about that. I certainly wouldn't make it a gospel point, as we say, but very, very interesting that there's this natural land bridge that God had there. So He led His people to that very location so that when the waters were stretched back, they didn't have to be 60 meters below the surface to walk through the water. They'd only be a few meters below the surface. So that's an interesting thing. Nonetheless, not just spread the waters and keep them as a wall on the right or the left, right and the left, but also it says they would go by on dry ground. So if you've ever been at the bottom of a lake or a river or the sea, it's not dry down there. It's muck. In some places it's a lot of muck. So God dried the land. He hardened it as well. So a couple miracles with that. So He suspended certain physical laws to make this possible. Often wondered, did God use angels to help with this? You know, you wonder how God does these miracles. What do these angels do other than watch out for us? I mean, they have other responsibilities. Well, clearly they do. Did God just, call up, Legion 7, I need you down here at the Red Sea, So 1,000 angels show up and they're all there holding the water as the Israelites walk through. I don't know. It'd be fascinating to see how God does that. I mean, God is a God that has, again, millions of angels. They're on call for various things. I don't know. Nonetheless, it's the plumbing brigade. I don't know what God had in mind here, but it's fascinating. God provided a way of escape, unlike anything they would ever have expected. But God opened the back door, we might say, and led them through it. So you'll go through on dry ground in the midst of the sea. So the waters again on the wall on the right and the left. Verse 17. "And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, So then I will, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal. There's God working on multiple levels again. When I've gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So in this case, it now provides this wall of fog to keep the Egyptians separated from the Israelites. They're not able to attack them on this little peninsula that they're on, we might say. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Do you ever pray for that cloud to stand between you and something that's threatening you? It's a great picture to have in our minds, that God can bring this pillar of cloud, or at night, fire, to separate us from our enemies, to separate us from those things that can harm us, that can hurt us, that could kill us. So it came between them. It was a cloud of darkness to one, this thick fog, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near to the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went in the midst of the sea on the dry ground. Just literally, the Hebrew says, just on the dry. And the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Now, it doesn't say how high the wall was, but it was a wall. And whether it's 6 feet of water standing up vertically, or whether it's 35 feet, it's still an amazing miracle. God is able to provide a way in a way we wouldn't expect. Verse 23. The Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Eternal looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. Now again, wouldn't it have been enough just to close the water on them? But God is, I think, a God of justice as well. So did he intend to terrify these people before he killed them? Maybe he did. Because I guarantee they would have been. As you start through this canal, water on both sides, standing up miraculously, it says, verse 25, he took off their chariot wheels. I mean, there they are. All of a sudden, these wheels all pop off. Like, yeah. And then I love the kind of the ironic phrase next. So that they drove them with difficulty. Instead of a chariot now, you've got a rock that these horses are trying to pull. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Eternal fights for them against the Egyptians. They did recognize that. So they wanted to flee. They changed their mind. We've often seen people who persecute God's people change their minds. Turn around. Verse 26. The Eternal said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. So at least the picture I have in my mind, that as the last of the Israelites is going through this passageway, the cloud simply continues at, 10 meters behind the last person. And the Egyptian army is coming, behind the cloud, getting into the middle of the ocean, this passageway, when God pops the wheels off, and they can't drive them anymore. They try to get back the other direction, but it's too late at that point. Verse 27, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Eternal overthrew the Egyptians. Literally, the word there is the Eternal shook off the Egyptians, like shaking off. You got a bug on your hand, you shake it off. That's the Hebrew here. God shook off the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots and horsemen and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. So just as a sidelight, someone has often wondered, does that mean every single Egyptian died? Well, it says here, all that came into the sea. So if it was a typical, military maneuver, you send in a brigade or, whatever your size army might need to be, and then you have others that come in afterward. So it not necessarily means that every single chariot or every single Egyptian soldier died, but all that came into the sea. There's not one that went in that made it out. Verse 29, but the children of Israel had walked on dry in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right and their left. So the Eternal saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. So the bodies washed up on their side as well as the other side. So God provided this amazing way of escape. Verse 32 or 31. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Eternal had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Eternal and believed the Eternal and his servant Moses. So clearly, we must remember that God will provide a way of escape. Often in a way we don't expect it, but he will care for us. He will provide the lessons that we need to be a part of his family. Let's go on to lesson number seven. Lesson number seven is that God will test us. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 8. And we'll just read the first two verses here. Deuteronomy chapter 8. God will test us. Again, sometimes God does that through direct intervention. Sometimes God allows our own actions, and maybe sometimes our own sins or our own foolishness to test us. Either way, God will use it to build the character necessary for his family. That's where he wants us. That's his end goal, is to have us in his family, ready to carry out the responsibilities he has designed for us. Lesson number seven, God will test us. Deuteronomy 8 in verse 1. Every commandment which I command you today, God says, you must be careful to observe. Why? That you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Eternal swore to your fathers. So remember, Deuteronomy, this is talking to the next generation after Israel has been wandering 40 years in the desert. Verse 2, and you shall remember that the Eternal your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness. God led the entire time. But why? Why did he do this? 40 years in the wilderness. To humble you and to test you. Some of the trials and difficulties that we come to face are a test. They're a test. It's not just a woe is me, something bad has happened to me. It is a test. And then it goes on to say, it's a test to know what was in your heart. Sometimes God likes to know what's in our hearts. Whether you would keep his commandments or not. Now he goes on specifically to say what he did for Israel, to Israel. He humbled you, allowed you to hunger. Sometimes God allows us to hunger physically or spiritually, emotionally sometimes. Allowed you to hunger, fed you with manna, which you did not know nor did your fathers know. Yeah, I deliberately wanted you hungry so you would come to depend on me. Trust me for your food. Went on to say that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Eternal. Christ quoted that later. You should know, in verse 4, your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Are you kidding me? You hiked for 40 years and you didn't even have a swollen foot? That's a miracle. Saw God's hand in that. You should know, verse 5, in your heart, that as a man chastens his son, so the eternal your God chastens you. Paul would later quote that in Hebrews. So what we see is God will test. Trial not only measures our conversion at times, but they correct us, they refine us, they perfect us, they strengthen our faith, they strengthen our resolve to obey God in every circumstance, no matter what the outcome. Last but not least for today, let's look at an eighth lesson from Israel's wandering. Their road trip from Egypt to the promised land. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 16. Lesson number 8 is God gives us what we need. God promises to give us what we need. Exodus chapter 16, verses 4 and 5. Remember Israel's complaint? They're out there, they don't have enough bread. Don't have enough to eat. Exodus 16, verse 4. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you." So talk about the ultimate panera. It's the heavenly panera, just loaves of bread, you know. Bags full of cinnamon crunch bagels just dropping out of the sky. I'm being facetious. The Lord will rain bread from heaven for you. In other words, he'd give them flour. They still had to make the bread. The people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them. Whether or not they'll walk in my law, he would teach them the Sabbath. They fail, but then most started to keep it. Verse 5. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they shall bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So you remember the story. If they kept it, it would rot. If they didn't, more than one night. If they kept it on the Sabbath, it didn't rot. Spectacular miracles. Point is, God gave them what they needed. So it was going to be there every day for them, day in and day out. The manna teaches us, likewise, to depend on the help of Jesus Christ in our everyday lives. He will be there each and every day. He is the bread of life. He said, what was it, John 6? You know, your fathers ate manna and are dead. But you eat this manna, the manna from heaven, the bread of heaven, Jesus Christ, and you'll live forever. And he said, well, give us this bread. Christ promises, like the manna, to be there every single day. And that's an important reminder that even in those dark times that we don't see, that certainly still is the case. Let's turn to John chapter 6. Maybe take a look at just a few of those scriptures before we close. We need to look for spiritual strength and help. To be reminded that this physical life is simply to prepare us for spirit life in the kingdom of God. So we're always asking God to teach us the spiritual lessons from these physical things that we experience. Christ gives this picture using this manna from Exodus 16 as an example. John 6 in verse, let's pick up verse 51. He said, "I am the living bread." Few verses earlier, he said, "Your fathers ate manna and are dead. But I'm the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I'll give for the life of the world." The Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, as you know, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They couldn't understand. We didn't understand that this was meant spiritually. That in the Passover service, when we take that bread, we're eating Christ's body, we might say. It's a symbol. Verse 53, Jesus said, "Most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." Passover is a required ceremony every year to keep us in the game, we might say. To show God we're still in the fight. As imperfect as the fight might have been during the past year, we're still in. Verse 54, "Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Now, it's not only talking about the Passover service. It's talking about an attitude of taking Christ's life, his example, into us at all times. My flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me, that's not just the Passover service, that's all year long. He who feeds on me will live because of me. So verse 58, this is the bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers ate manna and are dead, he who eats this bread will live forever. God will give us what we need. Depending on God each and every day for that day's needs is the equivalent to the Lord's Prayer statement, give us this day our daily bread. Now some of us have to pray for God's literal, physical daily bread. Not many in America do. But we need to pray for spiritual guidance each and every single day. Living off of Christ, we might say. Eating his flesh, drinking his blood on a regular basis. So, brethren, road trips can be a huge amount of fun. If we enter a road trip like Israel, there are some very important lessons for us to learn. We've covered 8 of them. Believe it or not, we have a number of others that we'll plan to cover next week. So let's be about packing for our spiritual road trip.